we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
You know, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Caroline Carnery.
Hi, everyone.
And Jen Dobell is our guest co-host today.
Hello.
Welcome, everyone. For our first interview today, I am happy to have local animal and political activist Beck Wonders back on the show. She has co-hosted with us before. Beck has recently written a carefully crafted essay on her blog entitled Eating Animals is Political, and in it, she explores some of the different facets that come into play when we make choices in our lives that we may think are solely personal, but in reality, they stem out into other realms of society and are, in fact, political. In this interview, we will discuss the points she makes in her essay that explain how and why our choices to eat animals create political implications. And for our feature interview, I'm happy to feature a fairly new local animal sanctuary called RASTA, Rescue and Sanctuary for Threatened Animals. RASTA has actually been in existence since 2001, but its founder, Lucy Cherney, moved the animals to Vancouver Island last summer to restart the sanctuary there. And we'll be having her on the show today to tell us about her work in rescuing animals and the educational advocacy that she strives to do in the community to go along with it. That interview is coming up in about 31 minutes, so please do stay tuned. Now, March 14th is coming up, and that's a very special day, isn't it, Caroline?
It's Save a Spider Day. Now, I'm not sure who designates these days to raise consciousness about the animals, but in this case, it's caused me to think on this issue of insect welfare and our relationship with the insects.
And I'm glad there's a Save a Spider Day because we need to think about these issues, right? It's certainly on my mind a lot because I cohabitate with spiders and other little creatures.
Yeah. And I fall into the category, the very vegan category of insects or animals deserving of their lives. So I try not to step on them. I shoo away rather than swat bugs that land on me. And spiders that come into my home go into the catch and release program. And if we have time, there's a couple of spider stories that we have.
I'm interested to know about this catch and release program.
Now, Allison, you're trying to live in harmony with an ant colony. How's that going?
Yeah, called it an ant farm.
An ant farm. I know.
I went to do my laundry yesterday, and I found about 200 ants on this jacket in the laundry basket. I was like, wow, this is really more of an issue than I had even imagined. I feel for these little creatures. They're tiny little ants. I don't know why they want to make a home in my bedroom, in my bathroom. And I'm constantly picking them up every day at any pretty much given time. I can kneel down and pick up about 20 of them. And the thing is you don't really notice them. Have either of you seen that movie Ant-Man, I think it's called, that came out last year with Paul Rudd?
No.
It makes me think of that movie because that film really puts a personification on ants. Showing what it's like to be their size and in their kind of world. You know, we're in big giant world. They're in their own little world.
Yeah,
and
true.
Honestly, you walk around every day and you just don't notice. And I step on them sometimes, but I really try not to. Like, I'm always looking around like, oh, I can only see them if they're moving, right? Otherwise, they're just like a little blip on the floor because they're tiny. I'm trying to live harmoniously with them. But at the same time, I have the catch and release program as well, as I catch a lot of them every day and I let them out and I wish them well. And I, even with bad weather these days, and I just think that you will be better off outside in the great outdoors than anywhere in my place. There's nothing here for you. There's no food. Like, I don't know how they survive. So yeah, that's been me lately.
Well, I think there's two kinds of ants, too. They're the kinds that you can live in harmony with, and they're the kind that will actually eat your home. And I did actually have in my home in Toronto, in Cabochon, carpenter ants, and they were eating the plinth on my house. And so I did not kill them. I had somebody come in and remove all of those plinths and take them away to a place where the carpenter ants could have a good meal somewhere far away from my home. And I lived in Mexico for 3 years, just returning last year, and life is different there. I had wasps on my ceiling. I had geckos running around everywhere. I had definitely had an ant farm in my kitchen. And at dusk, I had bats that would actually fly into my house in my vaulted ceilings and go around in circles and then fly out.
Wow.
And then once a year we had termite swarms. And I am talking about billions and billions of termites that fly into your house. You see them coming. You're running around locking doors and shutting windows. They come in by the billions and they go for any kind of light. So if your computer screen is on, they will be landing everywhere. So you have to turn off your lights. You close everything down and you sit in silence in the dark waiting for it to pass. Now, when the onslaught is done, you can generally, because all their wings fly off, they're just the vehicle to get them to the wood in your home. And then their wings fly off and then they live in your furniture. So it wouldn't have been unusual for me to actually clean up a pile of wings that was about a half a foot deep and about a foot around after one of these things.
So you've really had some experiences there.
And I've got moths right now, and I'm trying to work out a cohabitation agreement with them. Now, my partner, Mark, believes we're under siege and we must defend ourselves. And I'm saying, can't we live in harmony with our moths?
I don't know. What do you think, Jen?
I had a moth problem myself a few years ago, and it actually just turned out that I was buying too many bulk foods and not using them in time. So that solved the problem. I put everything in jars now, and there's no issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, with regards to saving a spider, I have saved many spiders. I actually have a device I call the spider catcher. It's basically a toilet paper roll tube with a piece of paper taped underneath it. I found it the other day. Although lately, I don't have a lot of spiders in my place now, although one really freaked me out the other day when I was cleaning the floor and he just like popped out underneath the stove and went, hi. And I was like, ah. And then I went in and I got the, I used to have this big gulp 7-Eleven cup. The bigger and deeper the cup, the better, right? Because I don't particularly care for spiders too much. Although I have to say that over my years of living with them so much and dealing with them, I got used to them. You know, they're like my buddies now.
Yeah, you named a couple. What were the names?
Oh, Fred and Mike.
Yeah.
Fred and Mike. I had Fred and Mike. They lived in my house for years because I had I had an infestation at one point where I think a bunch of baby spiders, so they were descendants, and they each had a spot, and one in the dining room, one in the storage room, and they wouldn't move, and they weren't hurting anyone. Yeah. But one day I thought, okay, your time has come. It's time to evict you. Bye, Fred. Bye, Mike. Be well.
Be well.
And that's my save a spider day. So anyways, I think we realized before the show that we have a lot of stories that we could tell, and
we might the spiders.
And all the little creatures. I've been thinking about them a lot lately, and they deserve, we don't think of them very much because we don't really see them or we think of them as pests, but they definitely deserve to be recognized.
And Allison, I was just looking at this morning, and there's 40,000 different types of spiders. We just think the spider. Wow. But you know what? They're everywhere in the world, on every continent except for Antarctica. So there's a little spider fact. And that
thanks for that spider fact.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food, sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food, hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
Direct Action Everywhere is having a teach-in March 26th, 11:15 to 12:30 Pacific Standard Time. Join DXE this month for a presentation and discussion on animal welfare. What is animal welfare? Why does it matter to the animal rights movement? How should DXE think about animal welfare? You can virtually join the presentation, which is happening in the San Francisco Bay Area, via Google Hangouts, or join in person if you're in the area. You can also request materials to host your own presentation and discussion by emailing mentoring@directactioneverywhere.com, or you can create and host your own presentation and discussion.
March 20th is Meat Out Day. Since 1985, activists around the world have celebrated March 20th, the first day of spring, by sharing their love of vegan food as part of a huge international event called Meat Out, which is coordinated by the Farm Animals Movement, but locally hosted in communities around the world. Every year, Meat Out introduces thousands of people to the benefits of compassionate diet for achieving great health, helping the environment, and of course, saving animals. If you want to host your own Meat Out event in your community, where you can hand out free vegan food samples to help spread the vegan message, you can register your event at meatout.org. On that site, there are also resources to get you going, including financial assistance. You can really make an impact by hosting one of these events for Meat Out Day or any day of the year, because if you get even one person to go vegan, that saves 24 and a half poultry birds, 3/8 of a pig, and 346 aquatic animals in 1 year. For more information on how to organize your own Meat Out event, you can also info@meatout.org. Also, FARM, the Farm Animal Rights Movement, is hosting the annual National Animal Rights Conference this July 7th to 10th in Los Angeles, and you can register now for the conference to get the special early bird rate of $100 for the 4 days. The deadline to get this discounted rate is Meat Out Day, March 20th, so register now.
And if you have an animal-friendly related event that you would like to share on the show, please post it on our Facebook page. It's Animal Voices Vancouver, or you can send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. So you are listening to 100.5 FM CFRO in Vancouver, Canada. This is the Animal Voices show, and I'm excited to have our first guest up. Our first interview today is with artist and political activist Beck Wonders, born in Sweden, raised in Germany, and with a Dutch nationality. Beck now finds herself on Coast Salish territory in Vancouver. Beck graduated from the University of British Columbia with a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy, as well as from Emily Carr University with a BFA in Visual Arts. Currently pursuing a master's degree in the publishing field, Beck is concerned with varying mediums of the literary and the visual. She is deeply interested in what makes up human nature and is convinced that we find ourselves in an irreversibly confused moment of human history. Motivated to search beyond a violent world, her work attempts to draw nuanced connections between what lies at the root of oppressive societies and the global unfolding of unapologetic and revolutionary politics. Beck recently published an essay entitled Eating Animals is Political, and she is here today to share her thoughts from this work. Hello, Beck, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me. I'm honored.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak with us about why eating animals is political, which you recently wrote about on your blog. We're happy to have you on the show today to discuss this. And to start on the subject of why something is political, let's talk about the notion of whether our private, everyday actions carry political weight or not. Some people say their personal choices are their personal choices and nothing more. But what do you think about this?
Yes, yeah, so I think that's an interesting question because I think that we tend to forget that all of our actions ripple into society. They do not happen inside a vacuum. And simply by being human beings on planet Earth, our mere existence has political implications. And I'd like to reference the early feminist rallying cry of the 60s and 70s, which went, "The personal is political." And this slogan still carries so much weight today. It's meant to highlight the fact that there's no such thing as being apolitical, and our seemingly most mundane actions, such as breathing clean air, drinking clean water, the land we live on, and so on, have political implications and consequences.
So let's talk about bodily autonomy. How do we take this away from animals when we choose to consume their flesh?
Yeah, when we speak about animals as being pork or steak, which is the norm in our society, we're intentionally omitting their personhood by using language that exclusively values what they produce. Now, keep in mind that the labor performed by farm animals is never actually compensated. It's, in essence, free labor from unconsenting individuals. And bodily autonomy is an issue simply because eating animals inherently violates someone's desire to self-govern their own body. And, of course, I'm speaking within a consumer context, which is different from the context of, for example, sustenance hunting for survival, or particularly when it comes to indigenous stewardship. But I'd like to add that liberal discourse tends to be very adamant about bodily autonomy for humans, and yet it excludes farm animals and instead justifies ideologies of domination, which is incredibly inconsistent with what liberalism sets out to do.
And I always like to make the reference to the dairy industry when we talk about bodily autonomy and the violation of the body. I wonder if you could speak about the issues in this when it comes to concerning dairy.
Right. Arguably, the dairy cow is one of the most oppressed farm animals simply because they are valued for only their reproductive system. I mean, dairy comes from impregnating cows, taking away their offspring, and then harvesting dairy which was not meant for humans in the first place. So bodily autonomy and animals is really highlighted quite well when it comes to the dairy industry.
Now, some people may argue that we give back animals their freedom when they are raised in what are known as humane or free-range farms. What would you say to this argument?
Yeah, it's interesting because people accept the notion of humane animal farming for some animals, but not for others. And the quote-unquote humane rhetoric is very performative, largely about a public wanting to feel guilt-free without addressing the root cause. And similar rhetoric can be found on quote-unquote ethically sourced chocolate certifications, for example, from West Africa, where chocolate is harvested by child slave labor. So clearly it's about language, image, and conscience, and not about material reality.
And speaking of just discriminating against different types of animals, the same thing wouldn't be said to be humane, would it, if it was a dog or a cat?
Exactly my point, yeah.
So Jen has a question for us here.
Hi, Beck.
Hey.
You write in the essay about the distribution of resources. There's a huge burden of resources being used for the billions of animals that are raised for our food every year. But let's talk about water, as World Water Day is coming up on March 22nd. What are some of the issues with water use in creating meat for consumption, and how are these issues political?
Very timely question. When you consider the entire process behind breeding, raising, slaughtering, transporting and packaging animal bodies, you realize quickly that huge amounts of natural resources are used. Most of our grain and fresh water goes into animal agriculture, and this is particularly infuriating when you think about the many First Nations communities across North America who do not have access to fresh water, most famously in the media recently, Flint, Michigan, for example, and yet we seem to be able to use colossal amounts of fresh water to raise cows and pigs for mainly city-centric populations, while many of our most impoverished communities are quite literally being poisoned. And all of this to highlight that Animal consumption is far from passive. It actively keeps poorer classes deprived from the natural resource they should have access to, while it sustains richer communities with the luxury of choice and the ability to look the other way.
You also mention in your essay that there's actually more water that is used for so-called humane meat production, but of course many, many people can't afford this type of meat. So what are your thoughts on that and those political implications?
Humane meat production requires far more water than factory farming, for example. And so this is a really privileged choice that a lot of people make in order to, you know, try and consume more ethically. However, because it requires so many more natural resources, it actually has very negative consequences for communities that do not have the privilege of choice.
Caroline has a question for you here.
Hi, Beck.
Hey.
The last political issue that we'd like to raise with you is the oppression of people in the system. Can you tell us about the conditions of the slaughterhouse workers? These people are hidden from most people's awareness in the system. When they sit down, they eat a steak, a hamburger, chicken wings. They never think of the people who made that happen.
Right, and I think this is an issue that isn't discussed enough. Animal agriculture takes advantage of a divided class system. For example, recently in Canada, there's been a shortage of approximately 3,000 slaughterhouse workers in the industry, and many recruiters are looking to newly landed refugees to fill the positions. Now, the majority of slaughterhouse work is performed by people who don't have citizenship status, who aren't entitled to security or benefits, who struggle to live above the poverty level and provide decent quality of life for their families. And this is one of the most desperate classes, which performs the routinized labor of killing, a labor that is incredibly psychologically damaging, having to perform the tasks that a majority of society willfully ignores. So it's important to keep in mind that animal agriculture isn't just oppressive towards animals, but the workers as well.
Well, we've covered some significant impacts on society that eating meat causes on a global and political level. And I was interested to read in your essay that in the 18th and 19th centuries, plant-based diets were actually associated with savagery and degradation in an effort to industrialize and colonize the meat-eating systems in North America and Europe. I didn't know that before. It seems like it's all been conducted in a really deceiving and sneaky way here. Is there a way, do you think, to reverse this heavily indoctrinated and deeply rooted system? And if so, how do we address this?
Yeah, you know, I think we're already doing it simply by talking about the root causes of how and why we've arrived at this industrialized food system is really important. And the entire business, and I say business, of eating animals is inherently part of the larger problem of domination of labor, land, and individual bodies, which is why the liberation of animals is inherently part of the solution as well. Now, what liberation of animals actually looks like and means, that's a whole other conversation. But seeing as animal agriculture is one of the most violent industries of our time towards humans, animals, and the environment, it increasingly needs to be included in conversations about oppressive governments and political analyses about the state control. There's just no way around it. Our food choices are heavily embedded with politics, and that's one of the key realizations necessary for reversing conservative ways of thinking about animals.
Well, I've got one more question for you, Beck, because I know you're an activist and you go out into the world and you speak to people, and I think you're fairly comfortable speaking with strangers. So say you're having a conversation with someone who you may or may not know very well, and I think this has happened to us all before. I know it certainly happened to me in the last couple of weeks, and a person will say, well, it's my choice to eat meat, just as we discussed in the first question here. It's my choice to eat meat. It's personal. So, of course, we've just had a 15-minute or so discussion, but say you only have like a minute or two, what do you say to such a broad and bold statement where it seems like this person thinks like, that's the end story. It's my personal choice. Don't bug me about it.
Right, and I think that's something that liberal ideologies and us in a liberal society, we focus on our freedom of choice. But freedom of choice isn't necessarily always a good thing because it affects other parties. And when something like your personal choice to eat meat actually infringes on someone's right to govern their own body, then it no longer becomes a personal choice. I always like to just say, you know, it's not a personal choice if it harms others. And I think that's a good thing to keep in mind when you talk to people about eating animals and liberalism, is that it's not necessarily always a good thing to be able to do whatever you want. Our actions have consequences, and we should keep that in mind.
Well, that's a great answer, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us today on why eating animals is political. To read Beck's essay and the rest of her blog, you can visit radicalwords.xyz, and you can find a direct link to the essay on our website at animalvoices.org. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today, Beck, and I wish you luck in the future.
Thank you. Looking forward to the rest of the program.
And you have been listening to Animal Voices here, and we've got some news for you now.
Yes, the Ontario SPCA has seized, on October the 15th of last year, 31 dogs which have been used for fighting. And three of them have, for medical reasons, been euthanized. The society has engaged with the American SPCA, who has evaluated the dogs behaviorally, and they have concluded that 21 of them, all deemed pit bulls, are a menace to society and cannot be rehabilitated. So, yes, to further complicate this matter, pit bulls are banned in Ontario. Now, the dogs are currently being held by the SPCA in Ontario at an undisclosed location. And Dogtails, this rescue organization that we were talking about last week on the show, is hoping that they can take ownership of the dogs. And I understand that the dogs' owners, the people who are running these fighting rings, are prepared to relinquish ownership of these dogs to Dogtails. And they want to work with the animals to rehabilitate them. And next week, they are going with Animal Justice to hopefully intervene in the court appearance. Now, part of the problem they're facing is that Dogtails is a rescue organization, but it's not a regulated kennel in Ontario. So they are actually going to have to apply for that status first before the dogs could even possibly be released to them. So it's a very complicated matter indeed. After successful negotiations with the people for the ethical treatment of animals in Canada, Health Canada has decided to drop its year-long requirement to test pesticides on dogs. The cruel practice required that the dogs, typically beagles because of their docile nature, were to be fed food-related pesticides for 1 year, then killed and dissected in order to study the toxicity levels. So typically each test would require up to 64 dogs to undergo the experiments for an entire year. And PETA has, really convinced them that this is unnecessary, given that the results would be known in 90 days. So the dogs are still being tested on, and they're being tested on in many different ways, but Health Canada has dropped this one particular test. So I suppose every little change of this nature is for the better for the animals. And a little bit of news light. In 2011, a Brazilian man found a penguin dripping with oil and starving by his home in Rio de Janeiro. I know, he cleaned him up and fed him and got him back to strength, and an inseparable friendship was born. When the 71-year-old man put the penguin back into sea, he thought that would be it. However, to his surprise, the penguin returned to the island a few months later and followed him back to his home. And every year since, the penguin spends 8 months of the year with this man on the Brazilian island, and only returning to Patagonia in Chile and Brazil to breed in the spring. So apparently this is a 3,200-kilometer journey that this penguin takes each year to reunite with this individual.
It's a beautiful story. Isn't I read about it. I think it's been kind of going viral this week. I have it set to appear on our Facebook page on Sunday, I believe, or I think either Saturday or Sunday. So if you want to check it out, Animal Voices Vancouver.
I love
it actually made it onto the Kelly and Michael show yesterday too. So everyone's talking about it. So I think if whatever we can do to get in just animals, positive animal stories into the mainstream, you know, even a penguin or whatever, a pig like Esther the Wonder Pig, and you know how that, you know, she's just like captured people's hearts and minds. Yes. And whatever animal, every animal, let's get one of each until people just realize that
identify
animals
with them.
Yeah, and animals deserve respect.
Well, look at the love and the attachment of this penguin coming all of this way to bond with this human.
I thoroughly researched that story because the link I saw had like a couple videos or a few like TV shows did stories on this relationship, and I totally poured through it. And one news source called, the name was Ding Ding, and then the other one said his name was Jing Jing. So that's a little bit confusion there. But but either way, this penguin, whatever his name is, he loves his person, his human from Brazil. Yeah, and I think you have one more story for us.
I do, and this is another Ontario story, and it's such a sad story. Last week at the Papanak Zoo, Zeus, an elephant, or not an elephant, a lion, escaped. And was shot. And so a resident of Ontario says it's time to crack down. And she started a petition that you can find on change.org. And it has almost 30,000 signatures and counting. And basically she's saying, let's get a licensing system that would give the government to the power to shut down these zoos that don't meet minimum safety standards. So apparently there's regulations, but there is no, law that says that they can shut down these zoos. So it's quite bizarre in that it's illegal to own a pit bull or wildlife such as a deer or a moose, but it's perfectly legal to own a lion or a tiger a zebra.
Even an individual?
Apparently this is the case. So
that is odd. It's strange.
And you can have these zoos that are meant for profit, and they don't necessarily have the equipment to or the safety measures to keep the animals locked inside.
Are you familiar very much with these so-called roadside zoos? I know they happen in east of here of Canada. I've never seen one myself. Is that what this is referring? Like, it seems like just anyone can like open up a zoo. And have them at the side of the road, too, which is even weirder.
Yeah. Now, I've been living in Mexico for the last few years, as you know, and you see this kind of thing all the time. And in Ontario, I'm quite shocked to read this, that in Canada we can have these kinds of operations, and it's just fine.
Canada really is behind in many ways when it comes to animal rights.
Well, I think it's really important. Again, I know I'm always pushing these petitions, but they work. Mm-hmm. They work. And every week I get notifications about something that's being closed down or something that's been changed or something that's been brought into law or a rodeo that's been closed because of these petitions. So, you know, of course I encourage everyone to go directly to change.org. Sign these and share these petitions.
I just thought of an idea for a future segment because you are the queen of petitions. Because I think some work and some don't. And I think you have the expertise and you should share that with us one day. So perhaps we could do that in the future
let's
get your petition activism going. Well, yeah.
Do I have any time or no?
We have 20 seconds.
I have 20 seconds. Let me just say that I was reading yesterday that Anita Crank, who started the Pig Save in Toronto, I just love her to pieces. This week at York University, she hosted an auditorium of 120 people to come and watch the film Earthlings. That's 120 people in a room. Then there were questions and answers afterwards. And I guess it was the Feminist Society of the University that put it on. And I just saw that and I thought, yay, to have 120 people watching that together in solidarity, learning and asking questions. I want to bring that here to Vancouver. I want to see that in every city.
I think we should definitely do that. Well, thank you for the news today. That was all
very
informative.
Yeah.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
Our feature interview today is with Lucy Cherney, who is the founder of Rescue and Sanctuary for Threatened Animals, also known as Rasta Sanctuary, located in Chemainus on Vancouver Island. Founded in 2001, it originated as Alberta's premier no-kill and cageless all-animal rescue with a unique non-discriminatory approach, and now has evolved to a permanent refuge for abandoned and abused animals, focusing on farmed animal rescue and advocacy. Lucy is here today to tell us about Rasta. Hello, Lucy, and welcome to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Alison. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today to speak with us about Rasta Sanctuary. I've recently been learning about your sanctuary and I'm excited to know more. Can you tell us a story about how and why you founded Rasta in 2001 and then how you came to move from Alberta to Vancouver Island?
Well, basically, the Rasta Sanctuary started because of one homeless dog, and where we were located initially in Alberta, just south of Calgary, it was quite rural 15 years ago. And a lot of people would drive out from the city and abandon dogs and cats and just drive away. And this became just a fairly big problem. And I always felt that someone should do something. And then I realized that I am that someone. And basically just started taking in dogs and cats that needed it. And when the Rasta Sanctuary started, it initially was more of a rescue endeavor and very much a dog and cat rescue, like a lot of the organizations, but with a little bit of a twist that we had more of a non-discriminatory approach, basically took in all domestic animals, regardless of breed, size, age, or species. And that eventually evolved more into a focus on farm animals and then eventually more of a sanctuary. As far as the move to Vancouver Island goes, that was a dream for many years in the making, basically to relocate the animals to a milder climate. We have a lot of aging residents at the sanctuary, a lot of pot-bellied pigs and different species of animals. And the Alberta winters were very harsh for many years. The average temperature in the wintertime is about minus 30, and it can be as long as 8 months long, the winters. And on a cold day, it's minus 50 when you've got the wind chill added to it. And so this just added a lot of struggles. And the idea with moving to the island, it was basically a milder climate for the animals for sustainability reasons. In Alberta, we were paying a good $1,000 a month to heat our barn just to keep it above freezing. And to come up with that kind of money, basically to keep farm animals warm, is not an easy sell in such an agricultural province. A third reason for us to move out was also to help animals, more of a voice for farm animals, essentially, in an area that lacks that. As far as we know, there aren't any other sanctuaries on the island that do things with farm animals.
Yeah, you're right about that. I'm actually from Vancouver Island, and I was surprised that you hadn't really been on my radar before, but I think you just moved there last year. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
We officially moved in the fall. Basically, in August is when we brought all the animals over finally. It was about 5 trips through the mountains to get everyone and everything across, and that was in August.
Wow, and that must have been quite a journey. Now, you say that over the course of your years in rescue that you saw a desperate need for refuge and advocacy, specifically for farmed animals. I'm curious to know why that is and what your experiences were like in being located in the premier farming province of Alberta in doing the rescue work that you were doing there. What was that like?
Well, basically, when it comes to animal abuse, over 99.9% of it is suffered by farm animals in the production of meat, dairy, and eggs. But even pet farm animals, basically, that find themselves in a rescue situation where somebody can't keep them, essentially, they have nowhere else to go. So that was basically the need there. In Alberta, being the heart of beef country, we faced a lot of challenges, a lot of ignorance and selective compassion that people would understand. As far as a rescue organization goes to take in dogs and cats, they had compassion for those animals, but didn't understand, you know, why would we take in cows or pigs or chickens when those animals could just be slaughtered. And so one of our main focuses is basically to try to evoke compassion for all species, all animals, make people understand that all animals feel pain and joy and love and suffer and everything like that. And in Alberta, one thing that was a great educational tool we found was Meatless Mondays, advocating just one day a week. If everybody in North America were to cut back their meat consumption just one day a week, it's the equivalent of taking 20 million cars off the road, which has huge environmental impacts as well as benefits for human health and obviously better for the animals too. And so in Alberta, we had to use a little bit more of a gentle approach with the Meatless Mondays. But what we found was Meatless Mondays often turned into Meatless Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, and so on as people got the information, essentially mostly about factory farming is the big wake-up call for a lot of people. And a lot of those people that started with Meatless Mondays eventually became vegetarians and vegans as well.
Wow. Well, I definitely want to talk more about the educational aspect later. But first of all, I've really enjoyed reading many of the animal rescue stories on your website. I found them really captivating and very compelling to read each individual story. And so I thank you for taking the time to write those out. Now, one of your focuses on rescue is that of potbelly pigs. And I wonder if you could tell us about some of your experiences in taking in these kinds of pigs and speak on some of the myths and realities when it comes to caring for potbelly pigs.
Yes, absolutely. And I really appreciate the opportunity to speak about this issue. Essentially, we've had a huge influx of potbelly pigs over the last few years. And the reason being is falsely advertised pigs as micro, mini, and teacup. A lot of unethical breeders are marketing them as these pint-sized pets, basically purse pets, which there is no such breed. The average size of a potbelly pig is 120 to 250 pounds, with some exceeding 300 pounds. And they're called miniature pigs because when compared to their farm pig cousins who can exceed 1,000 pounds, essentially they're miniature by comparison. And pigs also don't stop growing till they're 4 to 5 years old. So a lot of people who have a 1-year-old pig think, you know, that's the size they're going to be when they're about 50 pounds or so. The truly unfortunate part is the pigs grow till they're 4 to 5. However, they reach sexual maturity at just 3 months of age. And so what we found is some, especially corrupt breeders will breed basically babies to give prospective buyers the illusion that the parents are small and will stay small. Essentially, they're breeding piglets, and in no way are those pigs developed. Another big issue that people need to be aware of is potbelly pigs are actually illegal to have as pets in most cities and towns because they're classified as livestock. And it's one of the main reasons that they're rehomed next to the size that they grow into. And since we've moved out to the island, we've also found it very difficult to find vets that actually treat potbelly pigs. There aren't many around, and on the island, there's even less. And the ones that do are quite expensive. The spaying and neutering is around $1,000 and absolutely has to be done in order to consider having any pig as a pet. They develop a lot of behavioral problems like aggression as well as health problems down the road if they're not sterilized. And a lot of other considerations as far as tusks that grow on males that need to be maintained and the hoof trims and pigs, basically they're farm animals. They really do best in a farm environment with other pigs where they can freely express themselves, rooting around, wallowing in the mud and things like that, rather than living inside a house where they can't meet those needs.
Wow. And I'm curious to know, I didn't ask you this before, what variety, what kinds of animals do you have? And then I want to ask you about Theodore. He has a story that's originating at a BC dairy farm.
The animals that we have are essentially all sorts of farm animals, horses, donkeys, llamas, goats. We've taken in pigs, potbelly pigs, chickens, ducks, geese, turkeys, bunnies, as well as dogs and cats. We also had smaller caged animals a while back, like chinchillas and dagoos, and you even had a turtle. And Theo, basically Theo was found on a dead pile. When he was born, there was something wrong with him. And if an animal's only worth $20 or $50, the average farmer's not going to spend $300 on a vet bill. Because they view it as a business and it just doesn't make sense. And Theodore was brought to me by a good Samaritan, basically in the back seat of a car. He was so tiny. He was no bigger than a large breed dog, and he spent a fair amount of time at our vet. Our vet didn't think he would survive the first night, and then the first week, and it just took a lot of TLC and bottle raising. And 9 years later, it weighs almost 3,000 pounds. He is potentially one of the largest steers in the world. The record holder is 6'6 to the spine, and Theodore is about 6'3 or 6'4, and he's still growing. So he's quite a big boy. And when people come for a visit, basically we try to educate about the different areas and Theodore's story and so on. And a lot of people don't realize to this day that dairy cows, in order to have milk, basically they have to be impregnated. In order to lactate, they need to be impregnated, which means that there's a baby as, you know, part of the equation. And within 24 hours of being born on these industrialized factory farms, the calves are typically taken away. So the dairy calves, basically, they're a byproduct of the dairy industry. The calves are taken away within the first 24 hours, and they're either slaughtered that same day for bob veal, or they're immobilized in veal crates and kept for 4 to 6 months. And many of the people that know the horrors of the veal industry essentially wouldn't eat veal. And however, the dairy industry is the veal industry is essentially what we're trying to open people's eyes up to, that if you are consuming dairy products, you are essentially supporting the veal industry. And nowadays, there's so many alternatives as far as different milks go: almond milk, hemp milk, soy milk, rice milk, cashew, and vegan butters and ice creams. And even Ben and Jerry's has their own line of animal-free products. So basically, we're trying to advocate for those. Basically, they're much healthier for people, as well as sustainable for the planet, and obviously for the animals too.
Yeah, for sure. So in terms of how many of the animals at Rasta have ended up there, I understand that there are many desperate situations in which people are giving up and abandoning their animals that they no longer want to care for or feel that they can care for. I was actually quite astonished to read many of these stories on your website. Can you tell us about the types of situations in which some of these animals have come to you from, and the interactions that you've had with their previous caregivers?
Yeah, absolutely. We do get a lot of threats. We've had people threatening to drown kittens and shoot dogs, run over puppies in cardboard boxes and in driveways if we don't take the animals, basically being told that we're the last resort. When it comes to dog and cat rescue and you're full, there are a fair amount of resources out there that people can call other ones. But when we started up in Alberta, we basically were the only option for farm animals, and as well as others. And so it was basically guilt trips that people would try to put on us based on their bad decisions for not spaying and neutering their pets, having unwanted either kittens, barn kittens, or puppies, or other farm animals, basically, and their inability to continue caring for them, or a loss of interest, and basically trying to threaten us that if we didn't take them, that they'd kill them one way or another, take them into a vet clinic, or sending horses for slaughter, or threatening to abandon, and so on. And other ways that we've actually taken in animals other than the owner surrenders have been SPCA cruelty seizures, Humane Society surrenders, and as well as finding animals abandoned, sadly, and strays, and so on.
I want to talk about the educational aspect again. It looks like there is a lot of education that needs to be made towards all kinds of animals and all situations in which, you know, us humans have dominance over these animals or are their caregivers. So you say that education is the most valuable tool in rescue work. Can you tell us about that and how you use education at Rasta by having people visit the sanctuary?
Absolutely. Essentially, as a sanctuary, we don't have a large turnover. We don't do a lot for adoptions. our main focus is to provide permanent refuge for the abandoned and abused animals that we take in. And in many cases, it takes quite a few years to rehabilitate the animals. Some of them have bounced around from home to home or lived in just terrible conditions. And so it takes quite a while to rehabilitate them. And essentially, once they do, they serve as ambassadors for their own species. People that come to visit the sanctuary are able to interact one-on-one with the rescue cows and pigs and horses and whomever. And as a sanctuary, basically you get to a point where you're full. It doesn't matter how much money you have or how large the land is, you can't rescue them all. So education is the most important tool in the sense of basically preventing further suffering, educating people about the importance of spaying and neutering, making more compassionate choices in life as far as consumer choices go, educating about companies, you know, that still test on animals in this day and age, and just the alternatives that are available. And basically the goal with education is to prevent more animals ending up in rescue, like the so-called teacup micro mini pigs, which don't exist.
And educating people about the dairy industry too, because you have Theodore as an ambassador, right? Like, what do people think when they come and see the animals? And I guess they're, and then they start making connections in their brain. Do you see those connections happening?
We do, sometimes on the spot, sometimes it's something that's a bit of a delayed reaction. And it really, it depends on the different species. Different animals have different effect on different people, and you never know who is going to, you know, have the biggest impact. Theodore is certainly favorite of everybody's, but just his immense size. A lot of people don't realize that that's how big dairy cows can, or steers, sorry, can get if they're allowed to grow up. And so he definitely has an impression on people, but sometimes it's a duck, sometimes it's a turkey. And a lot of the misconceptions that people have, you know, about farm animals, turkeys being vicious or, you know, pigs being aggressive or whatnot, it's just great for them to see them how they should be living, basically, just in their natural environments, not confined in artificial, you know, factory farm situations.
Well, if you had to sum it up, what is your all-round vision or goal for Rasta Sanctuary? What do you see as being the main purpose of Rasta in terms of its impact on both the animals and the surrounding community of people?
Basically, our mission is to evoke compassion for all species. When people come and visit, as well as, you know, visiting our website or whatnot, just basically trying to eliminate speciesism. We find a lot of people, especially an older way of thinking, are victims essentially of speciesism, where, you know, you have the love for cats and dogs and whatnot, but there's that dividing line between these animals we love, these animals we eat. Well, we're trying to break down those barriers. That why is that? Pigs are the fourth most intelligent animal on the planet, behind chimps, dolphins, and elephants. And in that, right, they're much smarter than dogs and cats. So, you know, we're just trying to basically break down those barriers, taking in the animals that we can, obviously improving their lives, and then having them give back as far as educating.
Well, I know that Rasta runs on a volunteer basis, and I imagine you must have a lot of needs to keep the sanctuary going, especially with having relocated recently. So what can our listeners do to support the work that you are doing at Rasta?
At this time, donations are the most needed. you're right. As far as having relocated recently, it's hard enough to move from one province to another, but moving with a farm full of animals basically has made things that much more challenging. We are in a situation where we're needing to build up. We're basically starting all over again. We're rebuilding the sanctuary from the ground up here. As far as putting up fences, we're going to need to build a barn. This year we're experiencing water issues, so we need to put in drainage for the animals in the pens and so on. We are a registered charity, so we're able to issue tax receipts for donations. And we're also trying to encourage people to sponsor the animals, and basically that helps to provide feed for that specific animal. They can do so by going on our website, which is rastarescue.org, And we have a few other things there that we're starting up. We're basically trying to establish a support base in our new location. And we're also looking for volunteers to help out with fundraising, grant research, various areas of funding, in addition to the hands-on work at the sanctuary. In the summertime, we'll be putting together larger work parties to help out with just bigger construction projects. But at the moment, the biggest need is really sustainability of the sanctuary to have a good foothold out here in our new home.
Well, thank you, Lucy, for coming on the show today to speak about your work at Rasta Sanctuary in Chemainus on Vancouver Island. To find out more about Rasta and to volunteer, visit, and or donate, please go to rastarescue.org.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, March the 18th. It's our annual meet-out show, and we'll have a feature interview with Paul Shapiro, Vice President of Farm Animal Protection of the Humane Society of the United States, to speak to us about the latest updates in the meat industry and the trend of cutting out the meat. Plus, we'll have the program coordinator of the Vancouver Humane Society, Emily Pickett, on the show to speak about their new Go Veg campaign and their Meatless Monday program. So you can go to Animal Voices if you want to connect with us online, and we hope that you do that. Go to animalvoices.org. You can subscribe to the show via iTunes there and stream and download our shows as podcasts. You can also stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. We're closing the show now with a song dedicated to Lucy Chernay and to the animals at Rasta Sanctuary. This is Sanctuary Song by Daniel Redwood. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. That's coming up shortly. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. And remember to be kind to the animals.
Someone, not something. You're welcome here with your broken wing or wounded leg or branded skin. This is your home now. Come on in. You've known the pain, now feel the joy. What God has made, no man should destroy. From this day on, in the sun and rain, can run, jump, and play till the cows come home. Hang out with your friends, 'cause you are not alone. I want to tell the world what they've done to you so wrong. I want to sing for you a sanctuary song. It means as much to you as mine to me. I know that this is true. Your loving heart reaches out to mine, and the light in your eyes. the time, this is the place for us all to feel compassion's healing grace and pray for peace for all who share this one earthly home. So green, so fair, where you can run, jump and play till the cows come home. Hang out with your friends, yes, 'cause you are not alone. I want to tell the world what they've done to you so wrong. I want to sing for you this sanctuary song. May the whole world sing for you. May the whole world be for you a sanctuary song.